meant the beginning of an operation that pried open the door to a potential treasure of intelligence. The wrong decision would result in his arrest, identification as a CIA officer, expulsion from the USSR, and collapse of a multi-million-dollar operation that had the attention of the highest levels of the U.S. government. Exiting the bus at the final stop of his journey, Ken hiked 3 kilometers to the site. Although he had never been this close to the target before, the maps, casing photos, and satellite images that he had studied for months gave the surroundings a sense of familiarity. The site was, as advertised, technically promising and operationally vulnerable. Partially obscured by the narrow tree line, the new spring's foliage offered marginal cover. A curious look in Ken's direction at the wrong time from the driver of the tractor working the nearby field, or the unexpected presence of a Soviet citizen who had wandered off the beaten track in search of wild mushrooms, any of these, or 1,000 other unforeseen pieces of ordinary bad luck, could wipe out years of planning and research. The leafy trees along the roadway shielded Ken as he slipped into a pair of chest waders and pulled a specially made tool from the backpack to open the manhole. The operation required simple as well as sophisticated technology. Once in the manhole, the waders would provide warmth and dryness. But first, the manhole's heavy metal cover had to be removed quickly, a task for which OTS had designed a special implement. Fashioned from aluminum, the 12-inch curved tool was compact and lightweight, but strong enough to lock into a utility hole and pry the heavy iron slab from its position. Moving to the manhole, Ken inserted the pry bar and lifted, sliding the cover off the hole just enough to lower himself into the dank semi-darkness. That was easy, he thought, and made a mental note to thank the designers of the pry bar when he was back at the OTS lab. Descending the ladder, Ken stepped into cold water. Looking up through the partly opened manhole, he could see only a small slice of gray sky and a thick cluster of treetops. Measuring 4 feet by 6 feet, the chamber was 8 feet from bottom to top. Exiting from a matrix of conduits on one side of the manhole and re-entering an identical conduit matrix on the opposite side were the lead-shielded cables that carried the target communications along with the rubber-encased civilian telephone lines. Thigh-deep in cold water, Ken began the technical part of his clandestine work. His objective was to obtain samples of communications from the streams of high-speed data traffic flowing through the dozens of wires contained in each of the lead-sheathed cables. Although the CIA was confident the Krasnaya Pakhra communications were carried in one or more of the cables, Ken needed to identify the specific cable of primary interest by sampling signals from each of the dozen cables. The sampling and monitoring device carried in the shabby backpack was engineered to pinpoint that cable. Designed by a private CIA contractor, the collection equipment had been shrunk down into a 25-pound package that looked like a rectangular portable radio, with an array of indicator lights mounted on the top and leads set into one side to accommodate several probes simultaneously. The extracted data was recorded on what appeared to be a standard cassette tape, though capable of capturing high-quality signals on multiple tracks. Pulling the device and various components from his backpack, he meticulously assembled the equipment before applying a probe to the first cable. The only indication of technical success for Ken, standing in the bottom of the manhole, would be if the tape moved and the light came on. If an indicator light failed or the tape malfunctioned, he had no way to troubleshoot the system and would need to abort the operation. Ken placed the form-fitting 2-piece sensor, one section at a time, on either side of a cable and strapped it together with lengths of white fabric, measuring 1 foot long by 1 inch wide. He then tightened and buckled the strap to hold the sensor in place. Ken's 12 buckling straps were white by design. If he dropped one, white would be easier to spot in the poorly lit manhole. 12 was also an easy number to remember when he inventoried the gear prior to leaving the hole. No evidence of an unauthorized entry could be left behind. A grid of more than 12 underground cables entered the chamber, Although Ken's attention focused on the well-protected, lead-sheathed, and gas-filled cables, whose very design betrayed their significance. Since the data flow was often irregular, he needed to keep the monitors on each cable long enough to get an adequate sample. Above, the noise of traffic whizzing by, only a few yards away, was a constant reminder of Ken's vulnerability. If an inquisitive Soviet citizen crossed the road to look down the partially uncovered manhole, he would have come face to face with a CIA officer standing in groundwater amid a thick cluster of cables. It was tedious work. The position of each conduit and cable needed to be identified in a logical way. Working from a checklist, Ken collected samples, made identifying notations, and then moved on to the next grouping. A small bookkeeping mistake of misidentifying a single cable could invalidate the sampling. Working methodically, he was conscious that each additional minute in the hole increased the chances of discovery, while haste could lead to unacceptable mistakes. Ken had a second mission as well. While waiting for sample collection, he cased the chamber, photographing the conduit and cable layout using a 35mm camera outfitted with an infrared flash unit. This documentation would provide a current and complete record of the underground chamber, including details that could assist in any final design changes of the collar for permanent installation. Finally satisfied that he had collected and recorded adequate samples of the data, Ken inventoried his tools, repacked the equipment, climbed up the ladder, and poked his head out. With no one in sight, he emerged from the manhole, quickly slid the heavy cover back into place, and retreated toward the narrow tree line, where he removed the waders and stuffed them back into the rucksack. Ken was some distance from his family, but the pre-planned route that returned him to the picnic area was more direct than the one that brought him to the target. After walking into the park with no evidence of surveillance, he found another secluded spot, changed out of the street disguise, and returned to his wife and children, looking the same as when he left, a little more than 5 hours before. Sharon, although relieved to see Ken, understood the operation was not yet a success. If surveillance had paid attention to her and the kids and noticed Ken's absence, that would raise questions. American men did not normally leave their families alone in a park for hours on end. Wasting no time, they gathered up the children along with the picnic gear and headed back to the VW bus. Neither Ken nor Sharon relaxed on the drive home with the invaluable tape and tapping equipment in their possession. They drove carefully and continued observing cars behind and in front of their van, since no American was immune from accidental or KGB-staged automobile mishaps that could result in questioning or search. No celebration awaited Ken, although the chief anxiously anticipated a reason to return to his office that evening. While he had received no emergency signal from Sharon, he went to the office, opened the door, flipped on the light, and saw a sheet of paper torn from a government-issued notebook taped to the wall. Scrawled in pencil on the otherwise blank page was Number 1. It was Ken's simple signal announcing the success of a critical phase in the CIA's most advanced technical operation in the USSR. Based on the analysis of Ken's sampling, CIA identified the primary target cable and authorized installation of a permanent tap. For several years, C.K. Taw successfully recorded communications between Krasnaya Pokra and the Soviet Ministry of Defense. Then, in the spring of 1985, something went wrong. An officer sent to recover the tapes from the recording device aborted his mission when remote interrogation of the unit returned a tamper-indicated signal. After a few weeks, a second trip to the site did recover the tapes, but the system had ceased functioning, and the entire operation was shut down. What had gone wrong? For years, the virtually trouble-free American penetration of top-secret Soviet data streams had gone undetected before suddenly coming to a halt. CIA counterintelligence officers speculated the reason behind C.K. Taw's loss was more sinister than just simple bad luck. Had the KGB discovered the tap because of an error with a case officer's tradecraft during infrequent trips to recover tapes? Could the KGB have a spy who was privy to one of the CIA's most tightly held operations? As with the roll-up of an agent, the failure of the device left a host of questions, though for CIA counterintelligence, the answers were not long in coming. On August 1, 1985, Commander Vitaly Sergeyevich Yurchenko, deputy chief of the First Department of the KGB's First Chief Directorate, Foreign Intelligence, called the U.S. Embassy in Rome and offered to defect. Later that afternoon, Yurchenko provided the chief, Alan D. Wolf, with information about two penetrations of U.S. intelligence, one at the National Security Agency and a second, codenamed Robert, within the CIA itself. Yurchenko claimed not to know Robert's true name, but offered two important clues. Robert had sold classified information to the KGB in Vienna in the fall of 1984 and trained for Moscow operations, but was taken off the assignment just prior to departure. 2 days after receiving Yurchenko's information, the CIA's Office of Security informed the FBI that Robert was almost certainly the former CIA officer Edward Lee Howard. Howard, who joined the CIA in 1981, had been selected in 1982 to become a case officer in Moscow. Since he had always been undercover as a CIA employee and had not been posted abroad, he was considered clean and less likely to be identified as an American intelligence officer. In preparation for the Moscow assignment, Howard and his wife Mary received 6 weeks of intensive training on the clandestine tradecraft necessary for operating against the KGB in their own backyard. Training in detecting and evading surveillance was particularly rigorous, with field exercises conducted against FBI surveillance teams. Then, during a polygraph examination before his scheduled departure for Moscow, Howard admitted to drug and alcohol abuse, petty theft, and cheating during training. The CIA fired Howard in early May of 1983. Bitter and angry at the agency, Howard moved to Santa Fe, New Mexico, where he took a job as an economic analyst with the state legislature. But his troubles with alcohol and debts continued. A series of bizarre telephone calls Howard made, including one to the U.S. Embassy in Moscow, were so troubling that on September 24, 1984, a former supervisor and a psychologist were dispatched to interview him at his home. Howard revealed the unsettling news that, in October of 1983, he loitered outside the Soviet consulate in Washington, D.C., while considering whether to volunteer to the Soviets. Following receipt on August 3, 1985, of the CIA information identifying Howard as Robert, the FBI began surveilling Howard, but by the end of the month, Howard, sensitized by his training, detected the surveillance. In early September, the FBI began monitoring his telephone conversations. Howard was under 24-hour physical and technical surveillance. A little more than 2 weeks later, on September 19th, the FBI confronted Howard with information that he had been identified as a Soviet agent. To protect the real source, Yurchenko, the FBI attributed the information to KGB defector Oleg Gordievsky. Howard did not confess, but refused a polygraph test. Interviewed again the next day, he stated his intent to engage a criminal attorney over the weekend and agreed to another interview on Monday, a meeting he never intended to attend. During his CIA counter-surveillance training, Howard had learned to use the jib and how to roll out of a moving car while slowly rounding a corner. Lacking an OTS-designed jib, he created a field expedient version with a toilet plunger, coat hanger, and Calvin Klein field jacket taped to the top. The dummy's head was a styrofoam wig block and commercially available Jerome Alexander wig issued during his disguise training at the farm. Howard and his wife departed for dinner at a local Santa Fe restaurant on Saturday evening. While driving home, they made a slow turn off Garcia Street onto Camino Corrales, and Howard jumped from the car into the bushes. Mary propped up the makeshift jib in the passenger seat, buckled it in place, And minutes later, the FBI surveillance team clearly saw two people in Howard's 1979 Oldsmobile as it entered their garage. After spending the night at an airport hotel, the next morning Howard was on the first available flight from Albuquerque to Tucson, where he continued his secret journey to Moscow. The FBI did not discover his escape until some 25 hours after he jumped from the car. Howard's defection had a catastrophic impact on Moscow operations. His devastating betrayal exposed to the KGB collection systems, tradecraft techniques, covert equipment, and agent handling methods inside the Soviet Union, and specifically CK Taw. Howard had been one of the handful of officers to participate in the CK Taw operation, and in fact, during the polygraph examination that led to his dismissal, admitted cheating during an exercise in the mock-up of the manhole by replacing the weights in his backpack with cardboard to make it easier to get into the small opening. Almost a year later, on August 7, 1986, TASS announced that Howard had been granted political asylum in the USSR. Reportedly, Howard continued drinking heavily and died at age 50 in July 2002. Russian news reported the cause of death as a broken neck from a fall. Neither the Russian nor American intelligence services mourned his death. The significance of the American spy technology the KGB recovered from the manhole in the nearby cache was not lost on Soviet leadership. In a 1990 article that described and decried U.S. technical espionage against the Soviet Union, Lieutenant General Nikolai Brusnitsyn, deputy of the State Technical Commission of the USSR, complained that collection systems like CK Taw were interfering with arms control and reduction efforts between the two superpowers. Brusnitsyn concluded by admitting to Soviet anxiety over the ever-growing capabilities and scope of intelligence gathering and spying technology. Almost 10 years later, in 1999, veteran KGB counterintelligence officer Rem Krasilnikov, author of The Phantoms of Tchaikovsky Street, provided a Soviet version of the CK Taw operation, which the KGB had codenamed Billiard Ball. Krasilnikov described an inductance data sensor in the manhole as being connected to a metal box containing a tape recorder, control system to turn the recorder on and off during conversations, transceiver, and an internal power supply capable of operating the device for 4 to 6 months. According to Krasilnikov's account, the box was buried a half meter deep and located not far from the manhole cover. In this KGB version, the box was painted bright red with the Cyrillic inscription "Danger, High Voltage," protected by rodent repellent, and connected to a nearby ultra-shortwave, UKV, antenna. Krasilnikov, citing the KGB's technical analysis, reported the transceiver could be remotely interrogated up to 2.5 kilometers away. It responded with a coded signal indicating whether the unit had been disturbed, needed to have its tape changed, or required a replacement power supply. The analysis estimated that it was necessary for the CIA to service the unit only every 4 to 6 months. CK Taw's compromise did not diminish its achievement. For the CIA, the operation represented another remarkable fusion of technical reach and operational tradecraft, revealing vulnerabilities in the Soviet security apparatus. The imagination that conceived the operation, the engineering talent that built the system, and the operational execution represented a new kind of American technical collection capability. In the coming decades, the technologies developed during the CK Taw operation would be repeatedly applied to other equally critical targets.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.